Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Hello out there in internet land. This is John Stanko, your host for another edition of Wake Up to Purpose. This is our fifth week back in the saddle, so to speak. If you followed me a few years ago, you know I was doing this several times a week for several different entities and organizations, and then put it to rest, and we've geared it back up in this season where more people are at home, more people are searching for examples and answers to questions, medical questions, purpose questions, economic questions. So I've tried to line up people who could tell us their purpose story and could also add some relevant information that we need to know at this time. And today, in a few minutes, I'm going to bring on our guest, Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson. She and a group of associates were just with me in Kenya in February. We got home just in time, as it turns out, and Dr. Rhonda has been doing regular video updates on her Facebook page, and so we want to talk about her message as a medical doctor in this season, also her message as a woman of faith, and she is both, and so we want to hear from her and talk a little bit about her purpose journey, too. But I know we're going to have so much to talk about. We'll just have to trust that we can get it all in, because this is a woman who has a lot of really good things to say. So just stay tuned. Dr. Rhonda Johnson will be with us. But first, we just want to get focused. And since I was with you yesterday, we had Kim McCarthy, who just returned from serving with Samaritan's Purse in Italy at the field hospital they set up there to treat COVID-19 patients. Very fascinating story and of her involvement with Samaritan's Purse and her time in Italy. I had a couple of interesting phone calls today. One was a conference call or a group call, and somebody was saying that they are in the airline industry, and they were told that, you know, as long as they have the payroll protection through September, they should be okay. But after that, they expect travel to fall off and anything can happen. And so we're going to talk to Dr. Rhonda about restarting the economy from a medical point of view. But economically, there's no guarantees that, okay, we just flipped the switch and everything is fine. I think we could be heading for some challenging times there, which is why I am encouraging people to think about the new normal. And I know Dr. Rhonda's used that term in her broadcasts. And this is not a new term for me. I have worked for an organization called the Pacific Institute, which is involved in doing seminars around social learning, cognitive issues. And we have talked to people about creating a new normal. And when I, for example, 6 years ago, when I left my ministry position and started the publishing company, I was envisioning a new normal, and I had to act 6 years ago to make a reality what it is that I'm doing today. And so I've tried to share those principles, not only of 6 years ago, but 20 years ago, when my whole world shifted and changed, and I had to start over at the age of 51 and find things, new things that were in me, experiences that I had that I could turn into economic return. And that's difficult to do because we're very used to having a company that we can go to, and they would employ us for the services we have, and there's nothing wrong with that, but some of the companies won't be able to do that. So we're going to have to figure out individually what it is that we have and what we can do and where we go from here. And of course, if we're talking from a spiritual perspective, that God uses what I call cataclysmic events to reposition his people, because we're faithful people. We drill down deep. When God wants us to do something, we do it, and we do it come heaven or parts of hell or high water. But then if God wants to make a shift, he has to have us let go. And we're the hold-on people because that's what we've been taught to do, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when changes come, then we need to adjust to those changes. And yesterday on my Facebook Live, I talked about Joseph in the Old Testament and what happened in his life and then what happened in the world situation that got all him and his family to Egypt. And so I think there are spiritual implications to what's happening now. I don't pretend to know all of what they are, but I want to contribute my voice to helping figure that out. Now, what if you're a regular to the show, or if you're not, what we have been doing is the last 5 weeks, starting out every show with our inoculation of Psalm 91, and I have been choosing a new, different translation every time we read. And so today is one we're pretty familiar with. It's the New International, but it's not NIV, International Version. It's the New International Reader's Version, NIRV. There's no heading to Psalm 91. As many of the translations will summarize what this psalm is about. So let's just go ahead and read Psalm 91 from the New International Reader's Version. Whoever rests in the shadow of the Most High God will be kept safe by the Mighty One. I will say about the Lord, He is my place of safety. He is like a fort to me. He is my God. I trust in Him. He will certainly save you from hidden traps and from deadly sickness. He will cover you with his wings. Under the feathers of his wings, you will find safety. He is faithful. He will keep you safe like a shield or a tower. You won't have to be afraid of the terrors that come during the night. You won't have to fear the arrows that come at you during the day. You won't have to be afraid of the sickness that attacks in the darkness. You won't have to fear the plague that destroys at noon. 1,000 may fall dead at your side, 10,000 may fall near your right hand, but no harm will come to you. You will see with your own eyes how God punishes sinful people. Suppose you say, the Lord is the one who keeps me safe. Suppose you let the Most High God be like a home to you. Then no harm will come to you. No terrible plague will come near your tent. The Lord will command his angels to take good care of you. They will lift you up in their hands. Then you won't trip over a stone. You will walk on lions and cobras. You will crush mighty lions and poisonous snakes. The Lord says, I will save the one who loves me. I will keep him safe because he trusts in me. He will call out to me and I will answer him. I will be with him in times of trouble. I will save him and honor him. I will give him a long and a full life. I will save him. Now, as I said to you, this is not a magic potion. This is not an incantation that we declare, we read, we speak, and then everything's going to be okay. This is a psalm about trust. I just got off a coaching situation about 2 hours ago with a woman who had the COVID-19 virus, and she was by herself, and she had 3 or 4 or 5 weeks to think, and she spent a lot of time laying flat on her back, and she's rethinking her life. And so it's, as I've said, we trust the Lord for health, and if we get sick, we trust the Lord for healing, and if we succumb, as one day we all will, then we trust the Lord for salvation. But enough. I don't want to talk medical things because we have somebody who is much more capable of doing that than I am. So let me bring my guest on today, Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson. Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Thank you, Dr. Stanko, for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. And you know, there's so much we can talk about, but I guess we should just dive in. You've been doing, and I looked on your Facebook, you've been doing videos since March the 12th, and you did one just the other day about stress. Talk to us about your journey as a doctor over these 3 weeks. What have you seen? What have you been talking to people about? And I know there's a lot you've been talking to them about, but just as a medical professional, I'm sure you've never seen anything like this. We haven't, but what's happened the last 3 or 4 weeks that you've been talking to anybody who will listen?
Well, I am a pediatrician by training, and I practiced pediatrics for a long time, 20 years or so. And I also have a master's in public health, and mm-hmm. I worked in the public health area for part of my career. And so I had been following the COVID-19 outbreak in China. I had been reading about the properties of this virus, and knowing that viruses travel with people and people move around, just like I traveled to Kenya in February, people travel, viruses travel with the people, especially one that is as highly contagious as the COVID-19 virus.
Mm-hmm.
So I was concerned that I would listen to the news, I would listen to the state of preparation, and I was really concerned that people were not going to be prepared. Our leadership wasn't telling people when I started, really, to be prepared. And knowing what I know from traveling around the world, doing mission work, and my career as a pediatrician was always working with, I'll call them medically vulnerable populations, living in vulnerable communities that had limited social and economic resources. I really believed in my heart that this pandemic was going to hit people who were already surviving on the fringe, especially hard. And so I decided that God, you talk about God giving you an assignment, and the Lord had convicted my heart to do this. But like most people who get an assignment, we don't always do our assignments willingly. So I sat on this for a couple of days, and then I really just said, you know, go head on and do it, and talk about preparation. So a lot of my initial talk was just to prepare people. And there's a balance between preparation and inciting fear and panic. And so I've tried to really state with every message to be prepared, to plan, to stay calm, to not panic. I would repeat those messages over and over and over, yet while trying to get people to prepare to shelter in place, just seeing how long they had to shelter in place in other parts of the world. So really, that's where I started.
And now we're looking to opening up economies, and I think it would be safe to say you have some concerns, don't you?
Well, I think my concerns are well echoed by other medical experts in this country. We are at a place now in this pandemic. The first case of COVID-19 was diagnosed in the United States in the state of Washington back in February. The virus has been here for some time, but in fact, they've recently learned in California from doing autopsy evaluations that this virus had been here since November, but there was no way to test for it because we didn't know that it existed. And so this virus has been here. We've certainly seen how horrifically lethal it is. Over 58,000 people have died from COVID-19, and we have almost a million cases. We'll probably hit a million cases in this country by tomorrow or the day after. And keep in mind, probably many more people have this virus. They just haven't been tested because the testing has been in such short supply. So you're talking about a virus, when we look at the curves in the United States, and again, there's a lot of talk about these curves. There's a science of pandemic. People understand by what's called observational data, by looking at what has happened somewhere else. So we have the benefit here in the United States of having the opportunity to have learned at what happened with this virus in China, what happened in Spain, what happened in Italy. So we have the benefit of learning how what the incubation period is, how contagious this is. And so disease experts, statisticians, and epidemiologists, they're able to model what we've learned from other parts of the world and set up these predictions and curves. And what we're seeing from tracking the data, just what's been reported publicly, and our curve is still going up here in the United States. There's been talk about flattening the curve. That means when the number of cases and new infections fall down to, quote, an acceptable level. But we haven't gotten there yet. Now, the challenge, of course, has been with this pandemic because it's so new. There's no treatment. There's no way to prevent people from getting this infection. There's no vaccine, and it is so contagious, and for many people, it's deadly. So our health experts recommended what's called a mitigation strategy. When you can't contain, when you can't treat, you just go to mitigation, meaning you try to stop it from spreading further to people who are, you know, at risk. And basically everyone is at risk. So we've had to shelter in place. And that's been very effective in terms of keeping, let's say, Pittsburgh from having the same experience that New York City had. It was effective in California in keeping big cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, by sheltering in place, people minimized their exposure to other people. So what happens now, of course, people aren't working. Companies have laid millions of people off. The economy has almost gone to a standstill. There had to be massive government assistance to many industries. So you look at industries such as the travel and the hospitality industry, they're almost at the brink of disaster. You know, when you think about closed spaces such as airplanes and cruise ships and Navy submarines and schools and malls, guess these are perfect little breeding places for viruses to go from person to person, prisons, nursing homes, places of employment, restaurants, anywhere where people gather, you're going to have viral transmission. And this, again, because this virus makes people so sick, you know, we've seen what happens in, like, New York City when there's a multitude of critically ill people. It can overwhelm the healthcare system to care for them. And so it's just been a disaster. So as we look to reopen, we have to, you know, ask ourselves, and again, I'm not asking these questions. These are questions that are being asked by our elected officials and leaders. When is a safe time to reopen the economy? Now, you know, our country is really a country of 50 different states and territories, and our federal government is different than the state government, which is different than the local. Now, granted, I am oversimplifying this here. I want everybody to understand I'm a doctor. I'm not a politician. And I'm not an elected official. But they all have different ways of operating. And so what we're going to see here is 50 states doing 50 different things, although some of the governors have decided to operate as a region and plan and coordinate their reopening of their economies. So you asked what my concerns are from a health situation. Well, this has to be planned carefully in a pandemic. The reality is we still have no treatment. We have no vaccine, but people are suffering. They're not able to put food on their tables. You know, there's a whole lot of human suffering as well as a lot of human disease. And so the challenge will be, how do you reopen these economies in the face of a very deadly, silent, invisible pandemic?
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson, who's a medical director of health equity and quality services at her employer. And You know, you've been very clear, Doc, on your videos that what you're expressing are your own personal views, and
yeah.
And so, what's your feeling? I mean, what happens? And we're asking you to look into a crystal ball that nobody really can see clearly, but schools and sporting events and you just think now of all the contact you like you said, when flying or just in daily activities that you may brush up against somebody or we're going to be using restrooms, facilities if we go to public places together. What's your sense? Is this is going to be around for a while? Do you see it flaring up again? What's your, maybe it's your guess, your educated guess, but we'd love to hear it.
Well, given that we haven't contained the virus, that it's still very much around, and we don't know yet what the immunity of the general population is. See, there is this phenomenon called herd immunity. And the best way I'm going to explain this is if you were, let's say, born before 1960, you probably had chickenpox, naturally acquiring chickenpox as a child. And what would happen, let's say the oldest child or even the youngest child or the middle child, one person got chickenpox, usually a child in the family. They might have got it from someone else at school or camp, wherever they got it from. And then chickenpox spread throughout the household. Usually one child after the next got it. And let's say you had a family of 10 children. Well, by the time it got down to the 10th child, they may not have had any chickenpox lesions, where the first and second ones might have been covered from head to toe. Well, what had happened with that 10th child is that child got immunity to it. Even though they didn't break out, they were exposed to it long enough in the house that they developed antibodies to the chickenpox virus. So we don't know, first of all, what level of natural acquiring immunity exists in the population, because this is a new virus. And the longer it stays around, the more people might become immune to it. We do know, what we do know is that there are a lot of people who have asymptomatic disease, meaning they get COVID virus, and this is particularly true with young children. They seem to get this virus and don't have many symptoms. Your manifestations of this disease tends to be if you're in a certain high risk group, and that includes elderly people, and elderly people is defined as people 60 and above, or people who are have high risk conditions such as high blood pressure or high heart disease or diabetes, or who are overweight, or who have asthma, or chronic obstructive lung disease, or other pre-existing conditions that weaken their immune system, such as currently receiving cancer chemotherapy. So these people we know are at higher risk for having more severe disease of COVID-19. So we don't know who's immune. We do know that there are people who are very high risk. Some people have mild infection where they show no symptoms, and then other people get horrible disease, and we cannot tell. You and I might get COVID-19 at the same time, and one of us might have a severe infection and die, and the other one might survive, and we could have the exact same risk factors and have a totally different outcome. So that lies the challenge around, you know, knowing who's immune to this, we don't even know who's been infected because we don't have adequate testing. So we're trying to reopen the economy without really knowing who's got it, how many people are active, who needs to be isolated, who needs to be informed. Let's say someone in your household gets COVID-19. Well, there's a principle called public health tracing, contact tracing, where then they would figure out where this person has been, let's say in the last 14 days, and notify other people so then they could stay home. Again, you want to minimize. One person can infect a lot of people. I said on my video, I told a story about case number 31 in South Korea. It turned out this case number 31 was a woman who had COVID-19, and she didn't know that she had it. She went to a wedding. Then she went to a funeral. And it ended up that she indirectly, through her being exposed to this person, infecting them, and then they in turn infecting another 20 people, and then they in turn infecting another 20 people, turned out this one person ended up infecting, indirectly, of course, over 8,000 people in South Korea. Mm-hmm. They all got traced back to case number 31 exposure, and 85 of those people died. Because think about this, Pastor Stanko, before we started sheltering in place, what our days would be like. We'd get up, mm-hmm. maybe we'd walk, we'd go to the store, we'd get a newspaper, we'd go to work, we'd go to the gym, we'd go back to the store, we'd go get our nails done or go to the barbershop, we'd go mm-hmm. to church. Our lives were pretty busy. And, mm-hmm. you know, modern American life, generally, unless you're living out in the country somewhere, in the rural part of the country, but urban city dwellers, they're constantly around people. And so mm-hmm. that's what the infectivity looks like in a state where you have a highly contagious disease. So that's why reopening poses such a risk in terms of a resurgence. You hear Dr. Fauci and some of the public health experts talk about a resurgence or a phase, another phase two, or another phase three of this, because when we ease up these shelter-in-place restrictions and people start going about moving and circulating and mingling, we're going to see another spread of this virus.
Yeah.
So back to your question about sports mm-hmm. events and things like that, people are going to have to make these decisions. You know, the NBA shut down, the Major League Baseball shut down, hockey shut down because some of the players were getting infected.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know what's going to happen. But I mm-hmm. think people are going to have to ascertain, they're going to have to determine what is their risk factors for this and how to plan accordingly.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson, and what else is there to talk to a doctor about these days but the pandemic? And Dr. Johnson on Facebook has a wonderful series of videos that she's been very faithfully putting out, represent her own views. She's always very clear on that, but it's certainly educated, balanced. She's a woman of faith. She's a woman of experience. She's a family woman. I mean, she's coming at it from all different perspectives. And so let's shift gears a little bit, Doctor, and as I just don't want to keep you on this topic the whole time, and there's so much we could talk about. Talk a little bit about your journey that took you into medicine in the first place, because it's pretty interesting. It's been varied, but just talk to us about all the preparation and the journey that went into having you serve at a time like this.
Well, my grandmother, who's no longer with us, once told me a story that when I was 3, I told her, you see these hands? These are the hands of a doctor. Now, of course, I have no memory of that. I was 3 years old. But obviously, God had a calling on my life to be a physician at a very young age. And then when I was 14, I had the opportunity to participate in a program called the Health Careers Program I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I worked. My first job in healthcare was at the age of 14. I worked at a hospital, a Catholic hospital, down on the south side of Pittsburgh. It's no longer here. It's actually a senior residential facility.
St. Joseph's.
But yes, the St. Joseph's Hospital sure is. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's where it all sort of began. And mm-hmm. I remember, you know, at that time, we would follow the doctor around and and the doctor. Usually it was a he. It would be the doctor, then the nurse, and then me. And I, you know, had a chance to watch the doctors do the rounds. And I just decided that I was going to become a physician at that point in time when I was 14 years old. And I set on a journey. I always liked science. I majored in biology in college, and I went to Penn State Hershey for medical school and did my pediatric residency in Cincinnati at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Now, my decision to do pediatrics was quite a surprise to me because I just didn't think that I wanted to do pediatrics. I was always around a lot of children growing up, and I just didn't think I wanted to do that. But as I went through all of my rotations as a third-year medical student, I remember thinking, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And pediatrics was my last rotation. And on my first day doing my pediatric rotation as a third-year medical student, I knew that that was where I was going. And so I, you know, practiced pediatrics. I had a government scholarship for medical school, so I had to repay my government scholarship, and I worked in Albany, Georgia, and then I moved to Cincinnati and worked for the Cincinnati Health Department for many years and came back. I always wanted to come back to Pittsburgh, and so I've been back in Pittsburgh for a number of years now, almost 20 years, and glad to be back in Pittsburgh where it's home.
Yeah, you didn't mention one of the most interesting things in your academic journey, where you did your undergraduate work. Tell our listeners.
Oh, well, I went to undergraduate at Harvard University, and I was the first person in my family to graduate from college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
what was the experience? How'd you get to Harvard? You graduated South Hills High School. What did Harvard find you? Did you find Harvard? How did that work out?
Certainly, at the time, I cannot say that I was encouraged to even apply to college.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young woman who I served on a citywide student council. And she always talked about going to Radcliffe at the time. Harvard had a combined admission, but women were admitted to Radcliffe, and then they had their educational experience at Harvard. But she used to talk about how she was going to go to Radcliffe. And I just said, well, if she can go to Radcliffe, I can go to Radcliffe too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied, and my decision actually was between Harvard and the University of Chicago, and I chose Harvard, and I have no regrets. It was a wonderful, wonderful learning experience.
Mm-hmm. What was Penn State like?
Oh, the medical school was quite different. At that time, Hershey was very rural, and outside my window were cows and cornfields. But I chose to go to Penn State Hershey because I knew that medical school would be a little bit difficult for me, meaning that I had gone through public school education, and the early part of my education was in schools that were separate and unequal, and I spent a good part of my education trying to close the gap between my own background educationally and those of my peers who had gone to private and elite schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be in a place where I could really, really focus on my studies and not be distracted. And it was a wonderful experience being at Penn State Hershey. I didn't necessarily think so at the time, but after I was much, much older, I came to understand why God had really intended for me to be there.
Mm-hmm. And how was it in Albany, Georgia, being in the Deep South?
That was different. I had never lived in the Deep South. And, you know, Albany is a place right now that's in the news. It's one of the hot spots for COVID-19. They've had a horrible infection rate in Albany, Georgia. And it's a town that, as I went there, I was told by many, it's a town that is a city where Dr. King failed. I was told that over and over, even though I was there in the 80s and The civil rights movement was long departed. But that was challenging, but I've always been a person that strived to leave systems in place that were forever changed, and education is a great way to change practices, and it was through education that I was able to put some medical education programs in place and bring some specialty clinics in Albany, Georgia, that still exist today. And I really felt that I helped improve the quality of pediatric care during my short stay there, during my government service repayment period.
Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson. We started out talking about the pandemic and her view, and she was educating us with important information, and then we've made a transition to her journey, just a brief journey through medicine and how she came to become a medical doctor. And now let's talk a little bit. You are a woman of faith, and you attend a church here. But a few years ago, you and some associates and some friends got involved in missions. Talk to us about how that came about, and then tell us some of the places you went, some of the things you've learned, and then, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Kenya. But tell us about your entree, your decision to get involved more internationally.
Well, I came from a family of missionaries. In the African American church, the concept of missionary is well established. And missionary work includes both local missions, meaning domestic, as well as supporting mission work around the world. And most African American churches are very involved and steeped in a tradition of missionary work. And I came from a family of missionary workers. They didn't do global missions, but they were always involved in local missions. And so I knew always that I wanted to be a missionary, but I was a mother. I decided to be, my most important job was to mother my children and be their mother. And so I didn't go embark upon my missionary journey until my last child had graduated from high school. And then as part of my church, Triumph Church, which is a church here in Pittsburgh, I joined the international missions team, went to my first mission was in the Sierra Mountains of Mexico. We partnered with a faith-based organization in Mexico. We went up into the Sierra Mountains. That was very, very interesting. Then we went to Haiti for three or four years, Rio de Janeiro and Brazil for 1 year. And then members of our team went to Kenya. Our missionary team was open to, it wasn't just necessarily members of Triumph Church, although most people had some tie to someone in Triumph Church. I had the opportunity to lead missionary teams at least four or five times. Have had great participation from our teams. We've taken 12 to as many 16 people on these missions. And our missions have been a combination of medical care and education and economic empowerment vision support, where we dispense reading glasses and spiritual working with pastors and churches. Always my work has been faith-based.
Mm-hmm. So what'd you learn when you went out? I mean, you know, you had a lot of experience here in the States and a lot of experience in church, but what are some of the outstanding lessons? Hard or not so hard or obvious or a surprise? What have you learned now? You've got a lot of weeks under your belt as you've gone out. So just share with our listeners some of the things that stand out to you.
Well, mission work changes you more than it changes anyone else. Many people go on missions thinking that they're going to help save the world, but you're the one that comes back changed because you have a greater appreciation for what's really important. We tend to think about countries as being impoverished, but really they may be resource poor, but they have many other features of their lives that are far richer than what we experience in America today, meaning their societies are relatively stable, their family structures are intact, they take care of their elders, and there's no nursing homes where you put people away in nursing homes. Seniors are cared for as part of the extended family. You see the older children caring for the younger children. You don't see as many divorces as you do here in a, quote, more advanced society. So, and you see people, one thing that I really, really came to appreciate is the level of commitment to faith. We tend to take our faith sometimes as a Sunday thing. We go to church on Sunday if we go at all. But when God is all you have a different relationship with your faith. And that was a key learning for me to experience and to see faith and commitment to faith in a different light. And I've learned a lot. I've learned to appreciate all the things, big and small. I've learned that, for example, I could do without a lot of things that I previously considered as essential. I've learned that it's the simple things that matter most. Being connected, having that human connection versus having a material connection to things. Things don't give you happiness. Relationships and having that relationship with God is important, is so important. So I've learned a lot.
Yeah, you're so true. It changes us when we go. People ask me all the time, you know, why do you go? What do you do? I said, well, I do things, but I go because of what I get, not because of what I can give, because I'm always challenged. And, of course, our hearts and minds are with many of our brothers and sisters and friends around the world who don't have backup systems from government, and they're used to trusting the Lord every day, and they shop every day, as you know. And so we our thoughts and prayers, and I don't just say that, you know, sometimes that's a phrase, oh, our thoughts and prayers are with you. But no, they really are, and I know they are for you too. Let's talk about Kenya. This was, you know, a trip a little further than, you know, than you've gone on some of the other trips. But you know, you had a significant impact in Brazil, so you had a lot of experience. But talk about Kenya. What was Africa? And Africans can get offended, you know, when you lump them all in, you know, to because there's East Africa, there's Southern Africa, there's Central Africa. But what stands out to you about what you observed in Kenya on your time there?
Well, first of all, it's a beautiful country. The geography of Kenya is just beautiful. And although we didn't go into the desert per se, it's a country that has everything. It has a coastal line. It has mountains. It has a valley. It has deserts. It has beaches. It has, forests. It has a multitude of religions from Christianity to Islam, and they look like they existed side by side. And I also, from a health perspective, I was surprised when we went to the hospital to learn that 4 out of 10 Kenyans have HIV/AIDS. Probably one of the things that affected me the most, that I learned the most about, and you see the impact in the number of orphanages, the orphan children, because their parents died of HIV/AIDS. And you see schools that are also residents, they're orphanages. Several of the schools that we went to housed children and young adults who were orphaned due to their parents died from HIV/AIDS. So HIV/AIDS is a chronic condition here in the United States, and they're managing it through medications in Kenya, but they're still running the deficit, meaning HIV is still killing a lot of people in Kenya. And again, the evidence of that is the large number of orphan children. So that was a little bit surprising to me. But I was the hospital, the system of healthcare, it varies. People do the best they can, but we went to a hospital there, and, you know, it was interesting to see how the laundry, the sheets were outside hanging on the line, and the families had to get their food from street vendors. There's no cafeteria or trays that come around. You have to go outside to eat. And people, patients, you know, who are able to go outside, they go outside and they sit out in groups. And so it's a very different system. There's still children may not receive immunizations in Kenya. So there's still a lot of need. There's a lot of healthcare need in Kenya. But overall, the children appear to be well-nourished, meaning that it's not a country, from what I could tell, the places we went, with severe malnutrition. Again, that may exist in Kenya. I don't want to speak like I'm a health expert on Kenya health, because I'm certainly not an expert. But the children that we encountered, their families more likely had a cow or a goat. There was a source of food, chickens, milk. Probably the most fascinating thing that I learned was when we visited the Maasai village. The Maasai are indigenous people to Kenya and very much still live the way that their ancestors lived. And to be able to go into that village and to see how they live, to go in the houses, to see how they raise the children and how they, you know, tend to the cattle, and to learn about their marriages and bathing practices, that was very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when we went to Tenwick Hospital, which is a missionary hospital in Bomet, sort of west Kenya, it's about a 4 or 4.5 hour drive west from Nairobi, you connected with someone from your past that you had a significant role to play in her life. Tell us about that meeting and a little bit about what had transpired that brought you two together.
Yes, I was delighted to see one of the things I have always tried to do with my life is to be a mentor. I didn't really have mentors in my career development, and I promised God that if I got to be a doctor, I would mentor as many people as I could, and I would seldom, if ever, say no. So I had the wonderful opportunity to see a young lady who I knew was in Kenya, who I'd watched her and helped influence her career decisions to become a doctor, Dr. Amanda McCoy, who's from Pittsburgh and who's the head of the Department of Orthopedic Residency Program there at the hospital. So to see her there in her full capabilities as an orthopedic surgeon, and to see how well she was received, and to know that I had known her since she was in middle school, it was just a great joy. I felt like a mother. You know, I felt like a mother would feel when you reconnect with your children. It was just a wonderful feeling to see her and to see how well she was doing there in Kenya. Always a very, very bright young woman. So, yes, that was wonderful to see him.
Yeah, and I'm often going. I've been wondering how things are for her, you know, because for me, I hadn't been to that hospital in a few years, and it was so, from what I remember in the past, so much more crowded as we walked through. I really didn't prepare all of us who were going through, because in the past people were in their rooms. It was, you know, more like we would be accustomed to this time. We had people on gurneys and beds out in hallways, you know, people, as you said, sitting in clusters. Generally, it was only families we ran into. And so I've just been wondering, and I haven't wanted to bother her because I am sure she is busy day and night, but I just wonder how she's faring right now. And I can't get good, they don't have any testing there really, so you can't get good statistics, but I know on Saturday they were told another 21 days for lockdown, and they have a curfew from 7 at night till 7 in the morning. Nobody can go out. I mean, the police will deal with you severely. So anyway, it's a very serious situation, and I just pray God strengthens her and helps her and all the medical professionals there who serve beyond the call of duty. We've been talking to Dr. Rhonda Moore Johnson, who has been sharing really interesting experiences and a lot of important information on the pandemic and COVID-19. Doc, I guess it was just your last video, and it really made me think about the stress that people are under. You just did a very quick overview, and you know, I've been doing some paperwork to try and get some help with, you know, with my business and my work, and how frustrating it can be, and so just to kind of recap for us. I thought you had really good, soothing, pastoral, medical words. Just talk to us about, you know, what people may be going through now, and just any advice you can give them or people who know someone in these very difficult times.
Yes, this is a difficult time. There are so many levels of stress. Many people have lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. Many people are working from home if they're lucky. Children are out of school. Parents are having to educate their children. And for many, that's extremely stressful because, you know, most of us aren't teachers. And to have to try to teach your children all these different school lessons, all of my colleagues and friends that have young children and family members at home, that is a significant source of stress. Many people don't have enough food because the unemployment situation with getting unemployment compensation because of the swell of people who are unemployed all at once. You know, the systems that you can get on or you can't get through, and people are standing in line, and, you know, it's just been very difficult. You have families. You know, you may have someone that already has existing mental health conditions, and this surely will exacerbate it. People are watching the news, you know, and they're seeing this pandemic up and close and in their living rooms day in and day out because of all the media attention. And we're watching people die. We're seeing doctors and nurses crying on television. We're seeing people asking for help. We're seeing people getting buried in mass graves with prisoners digging their graves. We're seeing, you know, prisoners with signs saying, "I'm a person too." This is in our faces. It's in our lives. And then there's conflicting information. There's a lot of misinformation. There's politicians arguing with one another. There's inadequate testing, you know, there's no treatment. People are worried. Every cough, every sneeze, does this mean I have COVID-19? I get lots of calls about from people who, well, do you think I have it? What should I do? So this is a very stressful time. And then you have some families that already have stress. They have, you know, dealing with domestic violence and spousal violence. This is just not easy. So what I try to do first, you know, we have to admit that there's a stress burden. We have to admit that people are fearful and anxious. And then, you know, and then we have to recognize the signs of it. And some of the symptoms can be, and they can be different in older people versus children. But, you know, your sleep may not be the same. You may be overeating or undereating. You may not be exercising. You may be drinking too much or resorting to drug abuse. So, again, these are very real. But there is help. There's always help. And for those who are spiritual, we know that our Bible says, cast all your care upon him, for he cares for you. So those of us who are in the faith community, we have a few more tools. We know the power of prayer. But even for members of the faith community, this can be difficult. So one of the things I talked about was self-care, making sure that you limit the amount of news that you're watching or listening to or reading on social media, that you not feel like you're going through this by yourself. We are socially isolated. You know, we're physically distancing ourselves. So many people aren't having these conversations. You know, I think people should just get on the phone and talk about COVID-19. Just get it out. Talk about, you know, what's the most horrific thing that you may have seen or felt. Because when you hold it in, that's when you can start to, you know, have problems. So taking care of yourself, making sure you're getting some sunlight, some fresh air, go outside, wear the mask, of course, wear the mask, but get a walk if you need to walk. Put on music, put on inspirational music, take some deep breaths to let go of some of the anxiety that you may have internalized, and then knowing what to do if all those things are not enough. If you are seriously compromised, meaning that you can't do the things that you would normally do in your everyday routine, like if you're incapacitated, you're so depressed, you can't get out of bed, then you need help, and you need to know where to go for help, and you need to know that you can access help without being stigmatized or feeling like you're less of a person. So all of those things are important, and I try to inform people about where they can have resources. Many states have these suicide hotlines. There's a national suicide prevention line. People who have health insurance may be able to access counseling through a nurse call line. People can call their primary care or their health care provider. People can call their pastor. But the bottom line is seek help. That's important. This is going to be with us for a while. We're going to have to learn how to adapt to those of us who are lucky enough to live to see the end of the year, to see tomorrow. We're going to have to find a way to cope with COVID-19.
Yeah, it's not going away, is it?
It's not going away.
Well, Dr. Rhonda, thank you so much for your time. Thank
you're
you for
welcome.
Your wisdom. Thanks for sharing your life. And again, if someone's a friend on Facebook with you, I urge them to access your calm demeanor and your advice and counsel that you are so freely giving to all of us. Thank you also for being such a blessing to the folks in Kenya, and it was an honor to travel with you, and it's been an honor to stay connected since we've been home. So God bless you for what you're doing, and some of the things only God knows, and may he bless you and strengthen you to continue to do more of it.
And thank you. And then I just wanted to say also, I'm a member of the Gateway Medical Society, which is a volunteer physician organization. So check out the Gateway Medical Society on Facebook, or check out the website, because we will be having a lot of information available to the public on COVID-19. So you don't have to just be friends with me on Facebook. You can go to the Gateway Medical Society Facebook page or website or Instagram account, and we'll have a lot of resources there.
Sounds good. Thank you, Doc. You take care. God bless you.
Thank you.
We'll stay connected.
Thank
we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, Dr. Rhonda Johnson. Great interview, lots of wisdom. And tomorrow we have Charlene Dominic, A friend of mine has been clean for a number of years now. Wants to going to tell us her story, and the opening soon of a safe house for women. That is her passion. She's written three books through Urban Press, so she's going to have a lot of great things to say. She's enthusiastic. You're going to love her. And then my friend Doug Sprague on Thursday, and Friday, Ola Jackson, the founder of the Onyx Network for Women. Until tomorrow, this is John Stanko signing off. You be about the work of purpose.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.